From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, a big economic win for the state of Illinois, and former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan will be leaving the last elected office he still holds. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Our guest this week is Jeremy Gorner, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And Jeremy, always good to have you back with us.
Oh, glad to be here, Sean.
So, Jeremy, you just sat through a news conference announcing a major plant's going to locate in Illinois. That was announced right before we sat down to record this show. So fill us in. What's happening?
Yeah, so Governor Pritzker, Don Harmon, the Senate president, and, you know, other officials, they were talking about dubbed as a state-of-the-art $2 billion electric vehicle battery manufacturing plant. This is in Manteno. It's about 60 miles south of Chicago. This is part of Governor Pritzker trying to propel Illinois as a leader in, you know, in the electric vehicle industry. I mean, we've seen this with you know, other plants that have been that are being built in Illinois. You know, Rivian, for example, I know, you know, was obviously a big one. And then, of course, Lion Electric and Joliet. And this, so basically, this plant in Manteno is supposed to create 2,600 jobs for the town. And basically, this is going to be, you know, coming to this town. Of course, it's a world, it's this battery manufacturer, Goshen, they're a Chinese company. You know, and this kind of comes as, you know, I don't know if you recall, but when he was in London, you know, he was talking about how competition is fierce for, you know, EV related business, you know, across the country. You know, and he's basically, you know, won legislative approval for tweaks to the EV manufacturing incentive program. This comes on the heels. This includes a $400 million deal closing fund. So basically, this is part of, you know, what's funding this is going to come from that. That's basically, you know, what the announcement was today. And
I don't know if you said, but maybe you did and I missed that, but how many jobs were they talking about once this is up and fully running? Do they have a timetable for how long that
The plant's expected to begin production in, next year, basically. And it's being, you know, dubbed as the most significant new manufacturing investment in Illinois in decades. He's been really kind of promoting EV you know, throughout, you know, for the last 2 years, really. You know, obviously this is a big example of this.
Charlie, as Jeremy was saying, another example of the state trying to build its EV credentials, if you would, I want to say so. And you've got Lion Electric already operating at Rivian, which is a pretty good sized plant there in Normal. I would say that Illinois seems to be positioning itself pretty well as far as this industry is concerned, and certainly in the Midwest.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I found interesting is the two factors that we mentioned, Rivian and Lion, they both build vehicles. And of course, one of the critical things in determining the extent to which electric vehicles will succeed and become widely popular is the batteries. And having a major factory to produce these lithium batteries that will power these vehicles, I think is a big deal. It's another step in the, what would you say, like in the supply chain for making a reality the governor's push and the legislature working with him to try and position Illinois as being in the top of the, this one of the top states in terms of moving into electric vehicles. One of the things I thought was interesting too, Jeremy, and you maybe mentioned it and I missed it, the 2,600 full-time jobs are supposed to pay at least 120% of the average wage of similar jobs in Kankakee County.
Right.
mean, that would put their salaries at something like 55,000. That, in my mind, is important too, just for the overall economic growth and strength of the community. So I think this is really a big deal. And the IMA and the Chicago Chamber of Commerce were very laudatory in congratulating the governor and his team and the legislature for providing the opportunity to go and get Goshen to build their batteries here.
Well, Jeremy, was there any indication given as to why Manteno, which is near Kankakee, why it was chosen over, and I don't know if there were other locations being looked at or not?
They didn't talk about, you know, why Manteno, obviously. I mean, this isn't, you know, this is obviously something, you know, like Charlie was saying, Illinois has been kind of been lobbying this, you know, for a long time, and they've made it a priority.
So as far as the legislature's concerned or anybody else, I mean, this is a done deal. Am I correct on that? Is it over with as far as like, a, you know, signed off on, or is there more legislation that might need to be passed, some type of tax break, something to that measure?
As far as I know, it is. I mean, they're pretty much good. They're going to move pretty quickly on this. I mean, they were even talking at this press conference about, you know, a new battery that'll be available in the second quarter of 2024 that Goshen will be developing. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking 8 months away or whatever, or 8-9 months away for that. So, yeah, it sounds like they're going to get moving on this pretty quickly.
And Charlie, we've always seen where one industry moves in, especially one company moves in an industry, and it often will bring additional companies. You just mentioned earlier about, you know, vehicle manufacturing. Now we're talking about a battery manufacturer. So it seems as though this is the way you build this type of business climate, especially if you're trying to break into something like the EV industry, and Illinois is certainly wanting to do that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, and this has been mentioned by us in past discussions, one of the advantages that Illinois has going for it is just its location, being in the center of the country, with excellent rail, excellent water transportation, and that's something that operators or the decision makers at these kinds of factories consider. How easy will it be for us to get our product to market? And the location up in northern Illinois with the access to water and rail was probably a big factor in helping Goshen decide that, yes, we're going to put it up here. And I'm pretty sure, as we said earlier, all of the I's have been dotted and the T's have been crossed. I think the governor's news release mentioned how there's going to be property tax abatements going forward.
Yeah.
And the county and all the affected taxing districts have already signed off on those. And so it's really a big deal.
Well, let's move on to somebody we've talked about quite a bit on this show through the years, and even more so in the last, oh, say, year or two, and that is the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Charlie, word came down this week reporting that he, which he's held this position since 1969, but that he will soon be a former 13-ward Democrat committeeman in Chicago. And as I said, it's a job he's held onto even after he left the Illinois House, even after he stepped down as the chair of the Illinois Democratic Party. So is this the real end of the Madigan era?
Yeah, and in a sense, it's coming full circle for Michael Madigan, because his very first elected office was in 1969 when he was elected the 13th Ward Committeeman as a 27-year-old. And at that time, he was the youngest ward committeeman in the city. And that very same year, he started his career in state politics when he got involved in running for a delegate position at the 6th Illinois Constitutional Convention, to which he was elected in 1969. And then he served in the convention. And that is where I first met Mike Madigan as a delegate to ConCon, which I covered for the Sun-Times, Lord, half a century ago. And then, of course, he moved on to becoming Speaker of the House in 1983. He was elected then after ConCon. He was elected in the 70 election to the Illinois House. He started serving in 71. He became Speaker in 83, and he was Speaker for, well, from 83 till 21, with the exception of a two-year period when Lee Daniels, Elmhurst Republican, was a Speaker. And so he had an unparalleled record. And as I say, now he's come full circle, and this is his last official position with the party. And the person who is virtually guaranteed to succeed him is Marty Quinn, who is the current alderman and his Madigan protege. So I don't think there's going to be any change in that sense. Although the ward itself has changed dramatically. When Madigan was first committeeman, it had a lot of Irish, it had a lot of Poles, a lot of Italians, a lot of white ethnics, if you will. And now I'm guessing, I haven't seen the figures, but I'm guessing a substantial number of folks who live in that ward are Hispanic. They're of Mexican or Central American ethnicity and descent. So the ward has changed, but I'm pretty sure the Democratic operation probably hasn't, but we'll see going forward.
Well, of course, Madigan has a racketeering trail set for next spring. So, Jeremy, I mean, the time, I guess, is right for him to step down and or at least not run for another term and then focus in on his legal issues, which are many right now.
Right. I mean, we saw the four convictions in the obviously in the Common Four trial. We just saw, you know, Madigan's longtime chief of staff, Tim Mapes. We saw his conviction, you know, for the perjury and the attempted obstruction. So, yeah, I mean, that's five, you know, basically the feds are five for five when it comes to, you know, any kind of corruption scandal, you know, that involves former Speaker Madigan. So, yeah, I mean, with, you know, by spring of next year, you know, this is probably the time that one would think that, you know, it would be ideal for Madigan to step down. And of course, you know, with Alderman Quinn, you know, he's been really a lot more, you know, I know that in recent months, he's actually made more of an effort, you know, to make himself available to the media. I mean, I was at an event at a dog park down on the southwest side about a month or two ago. It was Quinn and Representative Guerrero Cuellar, you know, opening a dog park in Madigan's old district, in Guerrero Cuellar's present district, obviously. And before that, you know, Quinn was really never one. He kind of kept a low profile, especially with all the scrutiny, you know, surrounding his brother with the Me Too blowback in Madigan's operation. Of course, you know, Marty Quinn's brother, Kevin Quinn, you know, was basically called out in 2018 for allegedly sending a series of harassing text messages to a campaign aide. But obviously, I think like Marty Quinn's really kind of positioned himself in the last few months as trying to get himself out there. Like I said, he's been making media appearances, talking to reporters. So it seems like perhaps this was something that was, you know, in the making for quite some time, this transition, you know, of power in the 13th Ward, if you will.
And Charlie, I'd be a little remiss if we didn't mention before we move on that, because some people may look at this and think, oh, you know, the man has lost his House speakership. He's no longer state Democratic Party chair. This is just a minor thing. But Michael Madigan has always been about taking care of the home base. And you know that as well as anybody. When it comes to his district, when he represented them in the House, and also the city of Chicago in a general sense, this has really been his priorities.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. I was privileged enough and honored enough to be asked to write the foreword to Ray Long's excellent book.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, the house that Madigan built. And in it, I noted that one of his priorities was always looking out for the city of Chicago. And I cited a couple instances, one when they had the council wars, when Harold Washington was elected as the first Black mayor, and some of the white ethnic aldermen, Ed Burke, Eddie Verdoliak, leading the charge, attempted to block Washington's ideas at every stage. And at the time, Madigan's alderman was with the white ethnics, with the two Eddies. But in Springfield, when the rebel forces, if you will, tried to introduce legislation that would strip power from the Chicago mayor and give it to the city council, Madigan blocked all that stuff. And he was not going to have any part of that, of weakening the office of mayor, even though the folks in his ward and in his districts, by and large, were not happy that they had a Black mayor. And so he's always looked out for the city. He's always looked out for his ward. And I'm guessing that Mike Madigan is not going to take himself off and go down to Tahiti or somewhere. He's going to be there. He's going to be an advisor to Quinn. He's going to be available to help however he can. And of course, I mentioned facetiously going to Tahiti. There's also the very real possibility that he could wind up going to a federal prison. So,
well, we'll continue to watch that. And meanwhile, while Madigan is no longer the Illinois House Speaker, Emanuel Chris Welch holds that title, but he is getting some pushback from some members of his staff. And Jeremy, you wrote about this. There's some members of his staff, they want to form a union, but they're not getting very far. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, so it's more or less 20 staffers in Speaker Welch's office. They primarily hold research and legislative functions. Within the office, they call themselves the Illinois Legislative Staff Association. They've basically, this is obviously an effort. They're trying to organize independently. Among their demands, they want higher wages, better benefits. A lot of these are presumably younger, at least a couple of the ones I've spoken to are younger employees. Basically they're saying that Welch and his staff have rebuffed any efforts to meet with them to discuss this and let alone, voluntarily recognize their right to form a union. But this, comes on the heels of Welch and Governor Pritzker being staunch backers of, the passage of the Workers' Rights Amendment, basically codifying, anyone in Illinois, the fundamental right under the state constitution for workers in the state to unionize and collectively bargain. So far, Speaker Welch has not discussed this. I know that myself and other reporters have repeatedly gone to his office for comment, and it's and we haven't heard anything. I know that I believe that the speaker is in Israel right now. Governor Pritzker, the other day I asked him about this in Gilman, which actually is very close to Mantino, and he basically said that he didn't really know enough about the efforts of these 20 staffers, but did say that, but did agree that, certainly anybody in the state has a right to unionize. And of course, but it's of course entirely optional. And it could also be a matter of timing and kind of evaluating what, workers for a particular entity, what their demands are and what they're after. But definitely, I'm sure that this will probably unfold more in the coming months. Among what the association is saying, there's currently, 2.9, about three House Democrats per legislative staffer. That's compared to 2.5 last year, and roughly under two lawmakers per staffer in 2021. And they've obviously lamented that their average pay is less than that of House Republicans and Senate Democratic staffers, for instance. So this could be a little complicated, though, because I believe it's been reported that the state Labor Relations Board really can't act on these staffers' desire to form a union just because they're exempt, you know, in the law. Basically, legislative staffers are exempt in the law from doing so. So this could be something that, could result in, you know, maybe a lawsuit or who knows, you know, legal action. We'll have to see in court. But so far, like I said, Welch's office has not officially said anything about this.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on this, because you've seen legislative staff in action through the years. They work very hard, work a lot of long hours, not always for the best pay in many cases. But, is this come up before? Have you ever heard anything like this before?
Not in terms of the interest of legislative staffs wanting to unionize themselves. And I think back in my day, there were some staffers who were full-time people in the sense that they were lifers. And there were other people who were there basically for the connections that they would make. And they'd serve on staff and then they'd go off and join a lobbying firm or get some independent consulting business, that kind of thing. And so there was always the sense that for most of them, it wasn't that I'm going to be doing this the rest of my life. It was, this is part of my learning process to lead me on to something else. That said, I still think I can't fathom why Chris Welch is not meeting with these people. I mean, it just looks so bad on the face. Here Chris Welch is, he's one of the main proponents of the Workers' Right Amendment. And now his own staff wants to unionize and he's stonewalling them. I just don't see any value in that for Chris Welch. So my advice to him would be, when you get back, if you're in Israel, wherever you are, when you get back, sit down with your staff, ask them, how can we work something out here? What are the things that you want? And we'll try and address your concerns. The fact that they're not paid as well as the three other legislative staffs, because the way the staff is set up, some people work for the legislature, function in nonpartisan roles, but legislative staff, by definition, each of the four caucuses, the House and Republican, the Senate and House, Republican and Democrat, have their own partisan staff that does bill review, constituent service, all kinds of stuff. And for Chris Welch not to go along and cooperate and assist his staffers in addressing their concerns about pay, about work schedules, and about the ungodly amount of time they have to spend at session days, particularly near the end of the session, without adequate recompense. As I say, I can't fathom why he's not doing it.
And Jeremy, I know you haven't had a chance to talk with him directly about this at this point, but how long has this been going on? How long has this push been going on?
I mean, the push has been going on since late last year. That's my understanding. And it initially went public in May. In speaking with one of the organizers, they suspended their efforts right after the first news stories came out in May, about their efforts, because it was crunch time during session. They were too busy preparing the budget and so on and so forth. So, I think they were hopeful at the time that, Welch or his aides were going to meet with them the following month, but that never happened. And, in a statement that the association released last week, they said that they've been really, trying to get Welch to meet with them about this issue for 9 months. And it's, according to the association, it's fallen on deaf ears. So yeah, this has been something that they've been trying to move forward for, like I said, since late last year.
Well, it's time now for our notes from the field. And Jeremy, we'll start with you first.
I was at the DuQuoin State Fair last week for Republican Day. What was supposed to be the highlight of the day was the congressional race happening in Southern Illinois between Republican incumbent Mike Bost and Darren Bailey, who waged an unsuccessful bid for governor against Governor Pritzker last year. And Boss was not there. His a bunch of his supporters were there, but he was not there. He was in Decatur for the Farm Progress event. But Darren Bailey was, and they did not let Darren Bailey speak at this event. And you know, this was something that Bailey had kind of described as a pattern of, you know, he's trying to ban Bost and, you know, anyone affiliated with him kind of as part of the DC establishment. And, you know, Bailey has always kind of tried to brand himself as an outsider, a grassroots candidate, who's, you know, really kind of trying to overtake that seat. And of course, you know, the Trump factor kind of looms because Donald Trump has supported, he supported Bailey's governor bid. He's supported Bost for Congress. And I think as we've seen on social media, Bailey has been really aggressive in courting Trump for a possible endorsement in his run for Congress. Of course, Trump is going to be a bit busy with his four indictments looming. But again, you know, that's obviously just talking to a bunch of people at this event. That is something that everybody kind of agrees could be a pivotal factor depending on what Trump decides to do.
And Charlie.
The University of Illinois' flash index for August fell marginally from 103.2 in July to 102.9 for August. And that is its lowest level since May of 2021. But any value above 100 means that the economy is still growing in Illinois. And it's compiled by Professor J. Fair Geertz from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And he says, quote, "This month's seemingly negative result may be good news in disguise. A slowing economy is consistent with the goal of a soft landing that the Federal Reserve has been seeking. Recent economic indicators point in this direction." And so that's a good sign. And then the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with its monthly report. And it noted that the base revenue growth in the general funds for the first 2 months of the current fiscal year, which started July 1st, has been $362 million. It's roughly 5.5% growth. But it's taken into account the fact that last fiscal year, we had $764 million in federal ARPA money that's not going to be here. This current fiscal year, the actual bottom line is that we're down $402 million. But as the professor noted and as the COGFA noted, the base revenues, income tax, sales tax, those kinds of things are actually growing. So that's a good sign.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. You can find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Just look for State Week. Join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.